Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I'd like to welcome all of you back to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder. Today, I'm going to talk about Contact Report 31 of the Billy Meier case. This occurred on Thursday, July 17, 1975. It's a very long contact report, 30, 40 pages, something like that. Now, Billy's trip on the great Playaran mothership occurred on this day. Very interesting. Billy was beamed up into Semyase's ship to begin with, and they left for a trip around our solar system. And the first place they went to, actually, was Venus. And Billy jokes with Semyase about Venusians. Are we going to be able to meet any Venusians, as the contactees often said in the 50s? Billy says, what about the Venusians? Can one photograph them? Semyase says, you must be joking, because I already told you explicitly that this planet carries no human life forms. And Billy says, I know, I just wanted to see what you would say. Semyase says, I understand. You refer to the certain claims of alleged contactees. I know George Adamski and others have stated that they had contact with people from the planet Venus, and which conflicted very heavily with what our scientists have said about conditions on Venus, particularly temperature, which is extremely high, hundreds of degrees on Venus. And the Meier material does seem to confirm that. So in any case, Billy and Semyase are heading off to Venus, and they go down into these very heavy cloud banks on Venus. Semyase quickly told Billy about a trip she had actually made into one of the villages there in Switzerland, I guess. She had to pick something up. She picked up a photographic camera, I guess, for Billy. Billy had his own camera, but for one reason or another, I think that's what she was doing in Switzerland, actually. Occasionally, not very often, but she would literally, in different cases, in different places, actually intermingle with the Earth people. Now, that required her to wear a certain special technology to protect her from the vibrations of the Earth people, because we're at a lower level of evolution, and just our thoughts can adversely affect these extraterrestrials. So Semyase tells this story about how she, on a couple of occasions, has intermingled with Earth folks. In any case, Semyase and Billy are in the beam ship, and they've arrived near Venus, and they're moving into this very, very heavy cloud cover. And Semyase says here, there are still some things about which you have to maintain silence about. Certain things on Venus they weren't allowed to talk about. Okay, Billy says, of course. And he says, I quickly shoot the allowed pictures. Then the beam ship dives away from its position and rushes towards Venus. Immensely dense masses of clouds suddenly surround us, and one of the most greatly varied colors. The cloud cover, he says, is unbelievably deep, many kilometers, and there seems to be no end as they sink down into reach to the surface of the planet. And when they have penetrated far enough, the clouds change density and open up. And at about 40 kilometers of height, we leave the last cloud formations, and Billy sees the surface of Venus. And he sees the surface of Venus on two different screens inside the beam ship. And he says it looks rugged, there's craters, there are some mountains in one area. But Billy states that everything is basically lifeless and bare. But it looks more like our moon than a second Earth, like certain people claim. Billy says, I see. And how would it be if you would spin around the planet two or three times so that I can see other regions as well as the night side? So he also has the ability to travel extremely fast in the atmosphere of a planet. So that's what they're going to do. They're going to take several high-speed passes around Venus so Billy can get a good look at the way this looks. So it says here, Tsimyase sets the ship for fast speed, and they go around Venus a number of times. And they claim again that Venus is not the home to any human life forms. So the next goal they're going to go to Mercury and then on to the larger planets. So, but they travel back to the Earth eventually, and they're back in orbit of Earth because it's time for the Apollo-Soyuz. Soyuz was the Russian ship. The Apollo-Soyuz link-up occurred, and this is in 1975, July 1975, this contact took place. So let's pick up here. When at 4:40 p.m. we are back over the Earth, and I can see several flying objects in free space, besides two satellites of Earth origin. I can also see five objects which with certainty are extraterrestrial spaceships. Now, these extraterrestrial spaceships have the ability to cloak themselves. So Billy couldn't see them by looking outside a portal of the ship. He had to look on a special screen. And the people in Apollo or Soyuz, could not see these ships either. And this is confirmed by Tsimyase. Only one of the five beam ships belongs to her people. So the Pleiaren had a ship there, cloaked as well, but there were ships from other extraterrestrial races. Okay, let me pick up. Only one of the five ships belongs to her people, whereas the other four spaceships belong to other races who are here to watch the Apollo-Soyuz joining. So there's some proof that extraterrestrial races are observing the Earth. It says here, oddly, I can't discern these objects through the ship's windows or the viewing screen of his camera, but only on the beam ship's image screens. And Tsimyase explains to Billy that the ships are masks from view and only can be detected through the special zero visibility screens. Okay, anyway, in any case, they observe this historic linking between Apollo and Soyuz. And Billy is having some feelings of claustrophobia because they have the ability on Tsimyase's ship to actually look within these other ships. And it's incredibly small in there. And Billy is having some feelings. Here, Tsimyase explains, she says, it's true the capsules are very small and really offer no living space. I know it causes you fear to think that you could be there inside. You have good reasons to feel that way. And Billy says, you are speaking in riddles, Tsimyase. Tsimyase says, in time you will understand my words, but don't you want to look inside the capsule? Anyway, Billy evidently has some fear from a previous life where he's had a bad experience in a small capsule like this. Okay, so they witness the link up. And they're deciding to leave, and they're heading out to Jupiter to link up with a great mothership. So we'll pick up. I really like this on page 14 of this contact. Billy describes what it looks like in space. It's an awesome image. He says, without another word, she sets the beam ship in motion again, and already a few minutes later, the Earth has shrunk to the size of a large light blue object, shimmering bluish through space. So they've left the Earth. The Earth is like a little blue ball in the background. Having already observed this several times before, it doesn't interest me particularly, Billy says. So he turns to Semyase, who sits in her oddly shaped comfortable chair and directs the beam ship through the darkness of space. Now listen to how Billy describes this sight here. The darkness of space, in which billions of different glittering stars of many sizes twinkle 1,000 times clearer and more distinctly than they can be seen from the Earth. A truly fantastic image that I will never forget. There is heaven, as it lives and breathes, among the large and small stars. Innumerable groups of stars can be recognized, star clusters, spiral nebulae, the gigantic band of the Milky Way, in immeasurable beauty and size, and 1,000 other things. Everything is simply fantastic. And only now do I have an idea of the immense size and the magnificence of the universe. On the first flight, and also for the previous hours, I had not observed it well enough because I was caught and dominated by many other things. But now I look at everything in peace and with clear eyes, and I can't describe the infinite vastness and size and splendor and beauty of this universe that stretches out before me. The words fail me. It can only be seen and understood. And suddenly feel free and light and elevated above the struggle of everyday life. He says he feels elevated above the struggle of everyday life on the Earth. And he talks about feeling out of place on the Earth. But he doesn't feel out of place here. He says, here that feeling is simply gone, and everything is different in me. I feel really good and at home here. I don't know why, but it really is so. I am detached from all earthly concerns, worries, and problems. I feel free. Then Semyase starts to talk to him. So they're heading towards Jupiter, and the mothership comes into sight here. And it looks like a metallic planet hanging in space. And they head in the direction of this huge sphere that looks like a small planet. And then they can see a gap opening inside this ship. And this is an entrance hatch. And Semyase flies her beam ship into this entrance hatch of this very large extraterrestrial craft. How big is the beam ship, Semyase? Billy asks her. Semyase said, it's big. It's even very big, and it's the largest of its type. It's truly a special ship which embodies all the technology known to us. The ship itself will hold 141,000 inhabitants. It's something like 10 miles in diameter. And it's as tall as Mount Everest. It has the ability to jump from star to star system, also to move in time, and it can also penetrate the universal barrier between our universe and our sister parallel universe called the Tao universe. Now, Semyase's people, the Pleiaren, got this technology for building this ship from a group of people called the Timmers. The Timmers reside in this other parallel universe, the Tao universe. And Billy has had contact with one of these people called the Timmers, and her name is Asket. So Billy asks Semyase about Asket. Billy says, then tell me one other thing. You have told me once that you know Asket very well. Sannyasi says, certainly, there are no secrets. Askit has explained everything to me, so I know that you stood together in contact until about a decade ago. Billy, when Billy was 5 years old, he had 11 years of contacts with a man named Svath, who was a Playaran. After that, he had 11 years of contacts with this woman named Askit from the Tao universe. And then Billy had 11 years of a normal life, and then he started his contacts with Sannyasi. This was the 31st contact, occurred in July 1975. It's when he got to take the tour of our solar system, and then he flew out to Jupiter, and now he's meeting with Sannyasi. He's with Sannyasi. They've gone into the beam ship. But in any case, Billy says here, you are shockingly open, Sannyasi, considering that Askit has strictly forbidden me to speak about this before she would permit me to do so by a sign. Sannyasi says, okay, you've just received the sign. But she says, you, for the next 30 days, still cannot talk about these experiences. Sannyasi explains that after the predetermined breakoff of contacts with you in India in 1964, which were being led in collaboration with us and the High Council, she allied herself with our High Council, which are some beings from the Andromeda Galaxy. And from that resulted a quicker cooperation. So then Sannyasi explains how they got the technology to build these motherships. This particular mothership was only like 4 years old. Here's what she says. With the help of her race from the Tao universe, we came into possession of knowledge of higher technical capabilities and received the most exact data for the development of these great spaceships, which we have been using, as I said, for 4 years of your Earth time now. For Askit's people, the handing over this data was no problem because they had mastered the way of overcoming distances that these ships are capable of for more than 700 years. The people from the Tao universe have been able to build these kind of ships for 700 years. In Earth years, Askit's race is about 350 years ahead of the Playaran. So anyway, the exact the dimensions, the exact diameter of the mothership is 17,182 meters, and Billy's just amazed by that. Sannyasi tells Billy about a trip she made to Earth into the country called Turkey from some times ago, and she was retrieving some kind of probe. I don't know why they got off on this tangent, but they talked about that shortly. Then they describes them going up into the beam ship. The beam ship's extremely tall, and it has this large central portion, which they're traveling up the central portion to go to the bridge. And this is quite interesting. Let me pick up here. Okay, right here. We let ourselves float through the shaft by the transport beam and stand on the metal floor of the great spacer. For the first time now, I'm outside the beam ship. I realize the clear landing space. Okay, then they talk about other beam ships. Okay. And then this, something comes toward them. It's a small floating vehicle, no bigger in size than a Volkswagen car. And it floats about 20 centimeters above the floor, and it has seats. And then Sannyasi asked me to take one of the seats beside her, and the peculiar moving vehicle floats away and slowly rises higher and higher. And I look back and watch the transparent wall closes up again after our beam ship is taken by the previously seen robots into the main hangar hall. So Semyasi's beam ship is being handled by these robots. In the meanwhile, they're in this transparent floating vehicle that's about the size of a Volkswagen. Let me continue reading here. The hangar hall seems to take up the whole lower third of the giant spaceship. For its complete diameter, up to the height of 600 to 800 meters. The ceiling above, like the walls, also radiates a bluish light, which seems like the sky to me. And if I am not mistaken, there is a big opening above, exactly in the center of the ceiling. Soon I can see this is so, and we have headed in this direction in our floating vehicle, and we climb up inside the opening. So there's this shaft which goes up the middle of the craft. Billy and Semyase are in this transparent floating vehicle, which is rising vertically in the ship for thousands of meters, and then it kind of stops, and then it kind of goes into a side compartment in the wall. And in there, it says this: in here, there is an open space of approximately 2,000 to 1,000 meters. And I feel myself completely transported into a magical world. Wherever I look, I can see green fields, trees, ships, and flowers, a real little garden of Eden in this space giant. So within this ship is a large area that goes on for thousands of meters. I think it's maybe a mile in length of nothing but, you know, rolling hills and trees and plants, and it's just beautiful. So they see their ship as like an independent world. So they're up some 11,000 meters in the ships, and then they discuss that the ship is actually taller than Mount Everest, which is an amazing thing. Okay, they continue here, describing the exact height of Mount Everest, and that there's actually a taller mountain. There's actually a taller mountain in the earth than Mount Everest. If you measure mountains from the center of the earth, Mount Chimborazo is actually higher than Everest. Okay, we'll continue here. Okay, they floated. Okay, at the top of the spacer ship, they call it a spacer, this mothership, is a dome. And the leader of the ship is waiting to see Billy. And this is Ptah, and he's known as the King of Wisdom, and Ishwish. And this is the first time Billy's met Ptah. And Ptah is actually Semyase's father. At this time, Billy doesn't know that. Nor does he realize what kind of person Ptah is, because he's never met him. So in any case, Billy's making comments like he's not going to bow down before this god, this Ishwish, etc., etc. So let me read here what it says about Ptah. Semyase says, sure, and we all honor your thought forms. But for us, it was funny because you spoke so seriously and used expressions which revealed so openly all your feelings against bondage. And on the other hand, we also found it funny because you have purely earthly forms on our world. Because you have used purely earthly forms on our world. Even though we have for many thousands of years already known as well as thought and acted in completely different forms from the ones you just expressed. There certainly are still many subtle differences which can be perceived between ordinary persons and Ishwishes or other advanced life forms. But everything is still fundamentally aligned towards there occurring no more differences in appearance. So each life form is equal in value to the other. So now, they talk about androids here, and very human-looking androids. They say real biomechanical humans, androids. The whole command center is a giant dome cupola several kilometers in diameter. Over the whole thing spreads the free cosmos. Now, what they mean by that is on the roof. Wait a minute, I'm getting a message from Skype here, folks. I just want to read this really quick. My sound went out. I hope you guys can hear me. In any case, I hope everyone can hear me. In any case, I'll continue. I just got a message. Someone said that my sound went out. So they're actually, Semyase and Billy are now up to the bridge, which is this giant bridge at the very top of this structure, which is as tall as Mount Everest. And he refers to it as a dome cupola, and it's several kilometers in diameter. Now, on the roof, somehow they have the technology to display all the stars on the roof. It's some kind of transparent material. At least it looks like a transparent material. So Billy's just overcome by this beautiful sight on the roof of this bridge. In any case, they come up to the bridge and they can see Ptah. And he looks like an Earth human of about 70 to 75 years old. And Billy is introduced to Ptah for the first time. Now, if you're a person that listens to this show or knows something about the Meyer material, you realize that Billy has had contacts with Ptah now for a couple decades, at least, maybe 3 decades or more. So at this point, they know each other very well, but this occurred back in 1975. And then in Contact Report 31, there is a drawing of Ptah, Semyase's father. And then again, they explain that he's an Ishwish, a king of wisdom. I seem to have a gap in my notes here. So I'll just give a quick synopsis of what happens, and we'll have to pick up in more detail at some later show. But this is an amazing contact. And one of the things that's amazing about it is when the ship jumps from star to star system, everything inside the ship is turned into fine matter, almost like an energy. And then it's literally jumps across the universe. So one of the first places they go is to what they call JHWH Mata, or the Eye of God, which is the Ring Nebula. And what formed the Ring Nebula in ancient times was another Ishwish who destroyed a star during some war. So for the Pleiaron, this is an image of a symbol of the destruction that humanity can sometimes wreak on things. So it's a very sobering sight to them whenever they view this. Now, one of the things that Billy notices is when they jump, is he has this incredible feeling of peace just come over him, like total relaxation, total peace. And it's like a joy that he really can't describe. And he explains that to Semyase, and then she says they're going to suspend in that jump state for 7 minutes, just so he can experience fully because what he's experiencing evidently is what we all will experience when we go through all of our reincarnations and eventually merge back with creation. So the ship jumps and they suspend there for 7 minutes, and he's, you know, hopefully I can print out the rest of this and we can read it, because it's really something incredible. Billy describes this feeling of peace and wonder and joy and happiness and fulfillment, you know, higher than any experience he's ever had on the earth in his entire life. And then when they rematerialize, he can feel that loss of going back to material state. And he's also overwhelmed by the change in the two. I mean, to the point where he's almost ready to have a breakdown just thinking about, you know, that he'll, you know, how long he'll have to wait till he may ever experience that joy and peace again. So that's a very interesting thing. The other thing that's interesting about this contact is that they also travel to the gateway between the two universes, between our universe, the DERN universe, and the Tao universe. And that's a very interesting, because they actually take a trip into that gateway, and Billy is shortly reunited with Asket. And that's the last time he saw Asket, was in July 1975. So it's a tremendous contact, one that I've enjoyed reading for many years. And I enjoyed talking to you about that. I think I'm going to play a real short clip that I have about Venus that I think is incredibly interesting. So let's just take a break and listen to this clip.
Mercury and Venus, two hostile worlds that suffered very different fates. One, very much alive and seething with treacherous forces of nature. The other, a planetary carcass, gouged by millions of high-velocity impacts. Both demonstrate the true horrors of planets gone wrong. Mercury and Venus, the inner planets. Along with Earth and Mars, Mercury and Venus make up our inner solar system. Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, these planets farthest from the Sun, make up the gaseous outer worlds of the solar system. Over 4 billion years, the inner planets bound enough interstellar debris to become rock solid.
Why do we study planets? Why do we study astronomy at all? We someday need to go beyond the planet Earth if we expect to survive as a species for a very long time. And we need to know what's out there and what the nature of the universe is.
We're studying worlds where things are exotic, but the basic processes of physics and chemistry at work are really the same that we see here on Earth.
Millions of miles separate us from our rocky cousins. But a tour around Venus and Mercury reveals a common DNA.
We can go to Mercury and Venus and really look at these as places, as worlds, with their own histories, and then contextualize our own planet's history.
Well, welcome back, folks. I hope you've enjoyed the discussion of the great trip on the spaceship. I've listened to that, or read that for many years, and always enjoy going back over that. I wanted to bring us back into the book, The Psyche. You know, Billy's written a lot of very good books, and I recently finished The Psyche for the second time. And I wanted to go back over some things about reincarnation that I think are interesting. So let me read just a few sentences here. In order to reach the high evolutionary level mentioned, the human being must already have lived through his or her seemingly endless reincarnations of over 42 million years of his or her evolution. So there are 7 evolutionary steps for human beings. The first 5 of these steps take us about 42 million years to get through. And at the 5th level is the King of Wisdom, the Ishwish. The 6th stage, we transform into kind of a half-physical, half-spiritual state. So let me continue here. The human beings of Earth themselves, those created on Earth, are still so young that regarding their evolution, they are only beginning to change their last baby shoes. While those human beings living on Earth, who originally came from the far reaches of outer space, have only a total of age of 8 to 12 million years. So basically, the people who are the native Earth humans, the Homo sapiens that evolved here on the Earth, that are now reincarnating on the Earth, only have a spirit form about 4 to 5 million years old. People who came here from other worlds, died, entered into the reincarnational patterns of Earth, have a total age of their spirit form of about 8 to 12 million years. Therefore, the human being of Earth is not yet in the position to comprehend all nuances and forms of feeling. So, because of our spiritual age, we cannot even comprehend all the various nuances of feeling. Now, if you remember from studying the mind of thoughts, our thoughts, good thoughts, produce good feelings. And feelings are different than emotions. Emotions come up suddenly, raging, where feelings grow slowly and are inspired by thought. Now, one of the things in my own meditations or my own concentrations, and I've kind of put two and two together a little bit, because one of the things that Semyase has stated in Contact Report 10 is that every human has within them a spirit that records all of our thoughts and impulsations. It does not die, it does not sleep, and it will tell you if your thoughts are right or wrong if you've learned to pay attention. Now, one of the things that I've noticed is that negative feelings tend to come from negative thoughts. So that's the one way I notice when my thoughts are going astray. If they're becoming unbalanced, is that you'll have a negative feeling. So if you feel yourself have a negative feeling, try to step back and think about the thought that preceded that. Because good thoughts bring good feelings. Good feelings lead to good habits. Good habits lead to the circumstances of your life being good. And you are in control of the circumstances of your life. You're the master of your own destiny. Our monstrous power of our thoughts continually bring into existence everything that you could want. Now, the key here is controlling your thoughts, because you can have unconscious thoughts. You can have thoughts which pop up from the subconscious. In fact, if you are thinking in uncertain terms or in future tense about something, your subconscious will often convert that. But let me give you an example. One of the ways we stay in neutral positive control of our thoughts is having wishful dreams. And you're going to have to formulate your own wishful dream, a set of circumstances which you think are pleasant. A beautiful sunny day, watching your dog or your cats play. If you have children, watching your children play. Doing something you enjoy, walking out in the forest, or your own neutral positive vision. That is your wishful dream. Now, that will put you back in a neutral positive state. Now, if you think the thoughts, oh, I wish this to happen in the future, that's a no-no. You always wish, or you always think in absolute certain terms that this is happening now. And that's the way that your thoughts will get transformed back into a neutral positive state. Because if you use terms like maybe or in the future, your subconscious will immediately convert that into this cannot happen, your subconscious will undermine you and turn those into negative thoughts. So you have to think in absolute positive terms about your wishful dreams and about anything. Think in positive, logical terms. If you're thinking in wishy-washy terms, that is not logical. Nature works in absolutely certain terms, so you need to think in certain terms. Your thoughts, if you have a good positive thought, races out into the universe at an incredible rate, reaches some point, and then it comes back to you, and it attracts thoughts of likewise nature. So if you think good thoughts, those thoughts will come back to you. If you have a good, healthy thought, those thoughts will come back to you as good, healthy thoughts. However, if there is a polarity associated with that thought, it can be a good, healthy thought, but if you're shifted in polarity to the positive, for example, if you're thinking about a friend and you're thinking very positive terms of this friend, and this good, healthy thought goes out in the universe, when it boomerangs back, it'll be a good, healthy thought. But you'll see your friend in a little bit more balanced light. So it will be switched in polarity to the negative. So that's called the boomerang effect. The boomerang effect doesn't mean that good thoughts turn into bad thoughts when they come back. No, that's one of the confusions I had. A good thought always comes back to you as a good thought, strengthened. But the polarity can change to keep you back or put you back in more of a neutral, positive frame of mind. Because the universe, universal consciousness, wants us to stay in neutral, positive. That's where we evolve. Another important creational natural law is the law of striving. And this is talked about in the book called The Way to Live, which is another good book for you to try to track down and get a hold of. Maybe at theyfly.com you can pick one up from Michael Horn. And if I can find something about striving, I will read it to you. But the point is this: all things in nature have to continue to strive. If you stop your striving, then suffering comes into your life. Okay, here, let me read here. And those are the human beings in whom stagnation, called forth by religions and sects and through wrong philosophies and irrational worldviews, slowly but surely dissolves in order to concede the light of the creational truth. And thereby the striving, conditioned by creational law, is appropriate, its appropriate place in order to be evolutively effective in life and in death. Just as it was determined through the creation in unfathomable times for the incessant progress of all life to that which is higher and more absolutely fully developed. So all nature must continue to strive. Let me read this other passage here. Therefore, a human being who has ascertained the effective truth to such a degree can no longer have anything made evident to him or her from the outside, because he/she, in his/her striving, which is conditioned by creational law, fathoms all evidence in himself/herself by working with his/her ideas and gaining knowledge and cognitions from them, which he/she knows to convert in logical sequence into experience, which he/she then in turn forms into wisdom. So one of the things, as you evolve and your consciousness evolves and as you continue with your striving, you will determine truth in your innermost self. Truth comes from your innermost thoughts, your innermost feelings, your innermost contemplations. And that's where you do not need anyone to tell you what the truth is. You become an independent thinker. And independent thinking is critical for the evolution of the consciousness. Now, ironically, it's one of the reasons why they talk to us in terms of prophecy, to stimulate our independent thinking. Let me read here. All knowledge, recognition, and understanding and grasping and the experience for all things arise and can only arise out of the deepest depths of the human consciousness and therefore from the innermost part of the human being himself or herself. It is the human being's nature, as it is with every other existence, to strive in the course of eternal evolution. Continued striving, and you have to take on the responsibility of determining truth within your innermost thoughts, your innermost feelings, and your innermost contemplations. Anyway, it's a very different kind of book, The Way to Live. Different than Billy's other writings, it's hard to put into words. The information, sometimes it seems to stir something way deep inside. I can't explain it. It's not as technical as some of his writings. One of the most technical books that you'll ever come across is The Might of Thoughts. And let me read a section here in The Might of Thoughts that talks about belief a little bit. He slash she does not fall prey to belief wishes, which are in every form always unreal, harmful in the long term as well as disadvantages and damaging. And indeed also, when that is not recognized at first glance, in every case one's conscious and unconscious evolution is impaired. What Billy's talking about here is belief. People function on belief from religions very much, and it both unconsciously and consciously impairs your evolution to do that, which means that the human being does not, in his or her present life, achieve the quota of his or her evolutional zeal or an evolutional target. And he slash she perhaps even devolves. It's possible to actually devolve in evolution during a lifetime. And again, confronted in his or her next life with his or her missed evolution, which must then be made up for, whereby the efforts concerning this, however, will certainly then be greater and more strenuous. So if you miss evolution in this life, in the next life, it'll be more strenuous. So you want to get it as much as possible the first time. I'm going to highlight that. I left that unhighlighted. Life means achievement, evolving and fulfilling responsibility in the frame of the creational laws and recommendations. But to that end, hope and optimism are also necessary, along with many other values. Optimism in and of itself is a miraculous medicine. And Billy talks about the importance of being optimistic and the importance of having satisfaction and being satisfied in the current circumstances that you're facing. Because your mental disharmony is what causes your suffering to grow. If you feel mental disharmony, fall back on that wishful dream. Imagine it's a beautiful sunny day and your little cats are out there playing and all is well. And you can put yourself back in a neutral, positive state of mind. Because that's where your thoughts are powerful and you get centered again. And you'll regain control of your life. So these are important thinking skills. Optimism and in of itself is a miraculous medicine for the consciousness as well as for the psyche and the body. Contained with the optimism is the hope, therefore the expectation, the confidence, and the certainty. Again, we're dealing with absolute certainty. Do not think in wishy-washy, maybe, future. Your subconscious will convert that into something negative. You have to think in logical, absolute terms, which allows the positive thinker to still see in a neutral, equalized form a possibility in everything, even in the current time when so much disaster and so many terrible things govern the world. So you have to continue to focus on maintaining this neutral, positive thought forms in your mind, because we're entering into the third millennium. And in the third millennium, our leaders, as you may have noticed, are becoming megalomaniacal. They are taking away our rights of self-determination. There's a secret dark order in the earth, on the earth, that is working to gain control of all the governments and all the money and all the power. And confusion and maliciousness has spread over the earth. And people, unfortunately, are becoming obtuse and indolent, insensitive, slow to understand, because they no longer have the ability to have independent and logical thinking. So the challenge that you face here is to continue striving, to continue your evolution, to stay neutral positive, to use your wishful thoughts, your wishful dream, to maintain the neutral positive thinking. And if you can maintain that, you will have good thoughts, which will lead to good feelings, which will lead to good habits, which will put you in control of the circumstances of your life. You are the master of your own destiny. You have a power through your thoughts that is monstrous, and you can achieve things that you never thought were possible. But you have to stay in a neutral, positive frame of mind. Your consciousness is like a garden. And we have to nurture good thoughts. We have to clarify good thoughts. You have to say these things out loud if you have to. And these will put you in this neutral, positive frame of mind. And those weeds that jump up in your garden will slowly die away. And you will have luxuriously growing positive, neutral positive thoughts, which will continue to go out into the expanse of the universe and come back to you as neutral positive, but in a strengthened form. So as bad as the negative cycle is, it's just as good in the positive cycle. So you want to stay in a neutral, positive state of mind, and you become a master of your own destiny. So this is part of the spiritual teachings which Edward Albert Meyer was getting from Spoth, was getting from Semyase, was getting from Asket, but also getting from the wisdom of his predecessor personalities, and also from the signals of the storage banks, the Spiker Bank, the planetary storage banks, the universal storage banks, will send out symbols or signals, which if you have the sensitivity to pick up, you can benefit from those. You know, the creation radiates love, so that at every point you can, and finding, feel the radiating love of creation. For love is the highest principle in creation. And everything follows that principle in absolute logic. Every tiny plant, every tiny animal, only humans can function outside of love, can fall out of the neutral positive, because we have a free will. You are in control of your own destiny. Take responsibility for controlling your thoughts. You know, that's why electronic media is so appealing to people, because they can give their responsibility over to the electronic media, and they don't have to think. They can listen or they can watch something else, and they don't have to think. One of the greatest responsibilities that we have here on the earth is the responsibility to think. If you continue striving in your thoughts, you will reap very good benefits from that. Well, we've been reading The Might of Thoughts, Machtdeer Gedanken by Billy Meyer, a little bit from the book The Psyche, and also from The Way to Live. We talked about Contact 31, almost got completely through it. It occurred in 1975, July 17th, where Billy took his long trip in the mothership. Well, I hope you've enjoyed the show this afternoon, folks. We'll be back tomorrow afternoon. You've been listening to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder. Have a good day.